This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here, and also the invitation to curate the show Borders Without Ends here. As you were saying in the introduction, this is coming out, it's arising out of a previous exhibition that I curated for the Hugh Lane called Worlds Without Ends. So maybe I'll just give you a little bit of context as to what, where that arose from, etc. And it was an exhibition that myself and Sarah Reisman from the Shelley and Donald Rubin Foundation curated together. The genesis of it, I suppose, was around about 2018-19. We were having these conversations because the ex-president Donald Trump was in power. Brexit was not yet done. It had been voted through, but it hadn't been pushed through. So we were trying to sort of project as to what sort of world we would be living in by the time we had the exhibition. And the exhibition was originally programmed for 2019 and actually happened until 2021. And of course, what happened in the meanwhile was that we had the world pandemic, the COVID-19 struck, which changed the context of the exhibition completely. So going from an exhibition that was exclusively about borders, walls, which was pretty much on the global agenda, and that was coming from the context of migration. Countries as diverse as Austria, Estonia, Hungary, and Tunisia, they began to announce that they were building new border barriers. And this trend continued in Hungary and in Austria at the time of Europe, expanding their fences. And even in Norway, building of fences on the Russian border caused some tension. And the UK was funding a wall in Calais in France to hold back the tide of immigration. And also then in Pakistan, there was a fence that had been built to on the border of Afghanistan. So these sort of rising intentions is what our conversation was coming out of. And it was interesting as well that Trump won the election on the promise of building this beautiful wall. So, of course, we started to look at artists who were also looking at these concerns, Lane Byrne being one of them in particular. I saw an exhibition in the Kevin Kavanagh Gallery in Dublin. I forget the name of the exhibition, but where you had photographed all the type walls there from, on the Mexican border, so to speak. So that, again, was what was in my mind. But the pandemic changed it. So the exhibition began to expand a little bit, and that we started to look at the physical manifestation of borders and how they are contested areas. But also we looked at the mindset of borderization. So how a physical border can change the mindset of the people, the communities and individuals that live in proximity. So these sort of issues began to expand the premise of the exhibition. And hence we had 12 artists in total, each coming from slightly different regions throughout the world, international, and to look at their concerns in those areas. So that's where Worlds Without Ends became. And in it, Elaine exhibited the piece called Cold Rush, where she was looking at the contested areas in the Arctic up in Scotland. And Elaine, maybe you would like to expand on that piece of work in particular that you showed in the Worlds Without Ends exhibition.
Yeah, I guess Michael and I, we've worked together on two shows since 2017. So Cold Rush was in Worlds Without Ends. No, sorry, it was in Oceans After Nature, which was co-curated with Elena Claire Feldman and Michael. And then the work Blazing World was in the show Worlds Without Ends. Unfortunately, that piece couldn't come to Philadelphia for this show because of time constraints and moving a 400 kilo piece of coal was considerably difficult. So the piece that's in the show here is Cold Rush, which was developed, as I said, for Oceans After Nature. And Cold Rush came out of looking at issues of sovereignty in the Arctic, particularly around the Northwest Passage, which because of global warming it's become more accessible. And accessible not just for shipping, but also for all the other things that, you know, go on, which is like a lot of mining and obviously fishery, tourism, etc., which obviously will have big impact on the area. And then, you know, as I was looking into that, I was really looking at issues of how sovereignty claims are panning out in the Arctic, because currently there are several nations who are trying to extend their footprint into the Arctic area. And then when I was looking at Worlds That End, I was looking at the Arctic from a slightly different perspective, from a place called Svalbard, which has also sovereignty issues, but slightly different in the fact that it's kind of Norway versus the rest of the world, while definitely the Arctic is really, you know, US, Canada, Russia, Norway, Denmark, Iceland possibly as well. So slightly different group of participants in the discussion and debate happening in the two parts of the region. And I was kind of interested in Cold Rush, the fact that the video focuses on this flag being planted by Russia, which happened in 2007. They went 13,000 feet below into the seabed of the Lomonos Ridge and planted a flag. And, you know, this flag then caused, you know, a bit of a reaction from Canada in terms of, like, this is a very colonialized gesture. It's replicating what was happening 100 years ago with the UK when they were trying to colonize and claim lands in this region. And, you know, this kind of gesture of flag planting, or indeed other kinds of ways to claim land, such as, you know, the turf and twig ceremony, which is how actually William Penn claimed Pennsylvania. You know, were all things I started looking at in relation to the Arctic, because it's interesting when you look at, yes, you have somewhere like Canada, where, you know, a lot of Inuit peoples were moved to locations to claim land. For example, the place I went to, Grease Fjord, five Inuit families were moved there for 5 years and told, look, just go there for 5 years and we'll bring you back. But they were never brought back. And they remained there. And they were moved there in 1953, I believe it was. And then they've remained, I think there's 129 of that community still in Grease Fjord. So, that's kind of where the work came out of. Is that making sense to you there, Michael, or did I?
It is, no. It's amazing how pertinent it is today. I don't know if you're aware of what's happening off the coast of Cork. We have the Russians coming again. Just in international waters, but just inside our economic exclusive zone, the Russians have decided in a symbolic move, we think, but they're doing some military exercise, some naval exercises or something like that. But just it's the timing of it, you know, that when they're building up the forces in the Ukraine, tension is getting tight again over the areas of NATO, you know, its jurisdiction of NATO. it's amazing how it becomes so local, because we have fishermen who are going out who are going to take on the Russian Navy because their problem is not sovereignty, but their right to work. So apparently the testing ground is on in their fishing grounds. So they're going. There's a few fishermen heading out to take on the Russian Navy as we speak. And not only then on that, there was another. I heard from the talk in chat shows and stuff that environmentalists are going to get on board as well, because they said, "Well, why should it be blowing up? The marine life that's happening there." So it's nothing is in this globalized world that we're in now is done arbitrarily or is hidden anymore. That's the difference from going back to what you were saying, the British colonialism, that and going up to the top of Canada, that now an action cannot happen in this world without everybody knowing about it. We got our social media and how it has this sort of the butterfly effect of catching, knocking on to affect everybody. Everybody has an opinion upon it. So it's kind of, we'll see how this one plays out and how that interferes then, with societal, the culture of society. Because normally the politics is somewhat removed. Now it's so up and close because of the immediacy of the reportage that everybody is involved. And this then brings us into the whole area of artists as witness and the exhibition as form. So how do these sort of very pertinent and politicized acts get, artists get involved with them and through an exhibition form? How does that make it relevant, or does it make it relevant to this debate that we have? Or are we just talking to ourselves? What do you think?
Well, there's a couple of things. One thing I wanted just to say, it's interesting that you mentioned this, exclusive economic zone, which is like 200 nautical miles from your shoreline. You're supposed to have, exclusive rights to. But what's interesting in the Arctic is, the claim is, where is your shoreline? Do you include permafrost? Is that considered? Or can you consider a very large piece of an iceberg? Those things are being discussed about, how, and if you can conclude permafrost, you can extend your border of your shoreline by quite a bit, therefore claiming more of the seabed. So I think that even the whole thing of, the exclusive economic zone is also, questioned and not as permanent as we like to think of it.
Just to add to that, isn't there something coming up next year about the whole question of what international waters is? It has to be redrafted as such. Yeah. So the ocean will be the last contested space that we have on this planet.
Yeah, and they're planning to. I know we're going into the ocean now, but
okay, back to the original.
Well, I have to say it is quite interesting, because you're right that they're looking at as part of that to block off particular areas of the ocean that will be no-go areas to try and help keep marine life and keep some of the ecology untouched in the oceans. So they're looking at particular places in the various oceans that would be no fish rights, etc. Who knows? I mean, how is that going to be policed? I have no clue. It probably won't be. So who's going to be checking, and who oversees that? Again, these are things that are considerably more complex, I suspect, than a plan to do it. But it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years.
Could you, Elaine, just elaborate a little bit about those prototype walls that I saw originally in Dublin in the cabinets. When we were discussing this show, Borders Without Ends, I just wonder why you chose to go with Kush instead of the prototypes.
Yeah, I mean, I just put up some images actually of the show there. So that's the first room with Cold Rush. You can see the Russian flag. And here are photographs called Fortified Boundaries on this wall here. And these would have been shown in Dublin in 2018. And there is a selection of 20 photographs of all different borders throughout the world. And then this work is the one you're talking about here, Michael, which is the prototype walls, the 8 prototype walls. And on the opposite wall, you can see are the 8 photographs of the scenes. If you can imagine, centered down the gallery, I'm that's a dirt road, okay? And I'm in a truck with a built platform on top of the truck, photographing over the current border wall at the prototype wall. So literally turning one way, photographing the prototype wall, and then turning the other way and photographing the scenes that are facing those walls. So these are, you know, Mexican warehousing, Mexican homes, a lorry loading area, etc. So it's kind of really showing what these walls are supposedly protecting us in America from. And as you can, you know, you can't see maybe terribly well here, but it's, you know, a very poor region of Mexico, and not much, you know, there's no proper roads there. It's pretty bleak. So I had never shown the 8 prototype walls before. I'd shown one or two of the photographs in a different kind of context with a slightly different cut. And the reason for that is actually the 8 photographs are kind of quite beautiful. And in a way, you know, I didn't want to give them more attention when the walls were up. The walls were actually knocked down just at the start of the pandemic in 2019. So now that they don't exist anymore, I think these are more like an archive of something that was there, as opposed to, you know, having the photographs when the walls were actually in discussion, when they were actually being considered to be built.
Did you get a chance while you were on location to speak to any of the communities there?
The answer is nobody really. There was really nobody there.
Right, it's too far away. Too far out.
It's really quite a it's far out, but it's also let's say it's not a particular safe area. It's known for having some drug tunneling in that region, so it's not an area that you're going to find many people walking around. So I went there twice. The first time I went, it was 2 days, unbeknownst to me, I have to say, but it was 2 days before Trump was making a visit. So there was all trucks in front of the walls. I might have a photograph of that actually here on the side. So yeah, it was kind of hard to see the walls. Let me just pick these up here. Yeah. Everything's going to go slow today, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's.
I guess I'm interested in the symbolism of it and the power of the symbolism and how that was politicized under the Trump campaign and his beautiful walls that he was going to build. How that was harnessed, you know, in that, whether it was made for, as fortification or for protection and care to keep out. Keep out this alien, you know, fear that was propaganda. It's kind of into, but what my interest is in the power of that symbol and your photographs actually lies it very well, captures that power very well, I must say, in that, in a very abstract way.
Well, I think it's summed up nicely by Bhagwati, who said of, you know, Indira Gandhi's decision to build the fence was, it was the least disruptive way of doing something while appearing to be doing something.
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, I'm sorry, at least disruptive way of doing nothing while appearing to do something.
Appearing to do something.
Yeah. And I think that in some ways that was true of these as well. You know, it was a big PR distraction. You know, you could go on the website and you could look at the it was a public tender. So there was, you know, documents of what was expected of the public tender. It had to be 30 feet high, or sorry, 30 feet. It had to be able to dig. You couldn't dig down more than, it had to go under the ground by 30 feet rather. So, right. You know, you couldn't dig underneath it. You couldn't scale it. You had to be a certain size. And four companies replied to the tender, and one company actually produced three of the prototype walls. So, you know, it was, I think, similar to what was said about the Indian walls of fences, it was a way to be seen to be doing something. However, you know, the cost of building this, you know, they were 300,000 each of these particular walls. And actually to construct them, I think it was going to cost something like 2 million a mile, which, you know, actually compared to some other walls, like for example, the wall, the fencing between Morocco and Spain, which is 15 million a mile. It wasn't as expensive, I guess, but still, you know, the border wall, the border between, you know, the US border there between US and Mexico is extensive and expansive, and just would not, you know, the border crosses through rivers in some places. So, you know, just how are you going to handle that? So, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. I think there's a certain amount of PR to it.
There is. And obviously, when we were starting out, we had an utopian idea of a world without borders. That was part of the title, you know, world without borders, world without end. Was, you know, I sort of visualized this world that walked from one end to the other without meeting the border. But I must say that then the pandemic came and it just totally reversed my thinking on things, in that there was a certain need for borders to, you know, not that the virus respected it, but in regards to travel, to, you know, how the pandemic was spreading and stuff like that. There was a certain, there was a scramble in Europe, so much for the Schengen zone, to protect the nation's citizens as such. And it did sort of my thinking, I must say, you know, it's certainly not in the same position. I don't know where I am, but I'm not in the same position that I was in 2019, now in 2022, on how that symbol, how that powerful symbol of border is, should be utilized. Mm. Another complication in the mix that's in my head as well is the is the, you know, the politicization of immigrants, you know, of, you know, when Orland in Hungary was beginning to direct the Syrian refugee towards the border to create tension with Europe. There's just, it's just becomes so complicated. And it's only up to artists like you who can draw our attention to these flashpoints and to sort of humanize, I suppose, some of the dilemmas, the complex dilemmas that are happening. I mean, would you see yourself in that category of an activist artist?
No, I wouldn't, actually. I think that certainly my work engages with political issues, but I do feel that an activist artist is much more tends to engage with work in a very different way in terms of, like, let's say, the feet on the ground is different, Michael, I would have thought. However, you know, my work certainly deals with political, social issues, and to a certain extent, you know, I may have a very light touch when it comes to the activist, but I wouldn't claim it because that would, to me, wouldn't be fair for the artists who are activist artists who are really, really committed to that practice. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, that you mentioned borderlessness, because I know you and I have talked about this before, because, you know, scholars, like many scholars would say, like one particular one actually, who's an Irish scholar based in the States, O'Toole, would say that actually this concept of, you know, a borderless world is really a neoliberal ideology. And, you know, we need to be thinking about borders in a different way. And, you know, he's talking about looking at more of relations of power and knowledge, and how, you know, different discourses are implicated in various relations of power and knowledge, as opposed to, you know, his view being the discourse of a borderless world is, an attempt to maybe denaturalize and limit the power of states in order to bolster the virtues of a friction-free market. So, yeah, I mean, you know, to some other thinkers who talk about this idea of civic registration, which is more maybe in common with Svalbard, where you have a place where as long as you can look after yourself and you don't have a criminal record and you're willing to live according to the democratic rule of the place, you can live and work there. And that's Svalbard. You can live and work in Svalbard without a visa, as long as you can look after yourself and you don't have a criminal record. So, you know, that was interesting as you brought up the pandemic, because, you know, this idea of a place like that sounds great and sounds quite, utopic until you get to something like the pandemic. And then you definitely did see a difference happening in a place like Svalbard.
Yeah.
Who had the rights there for care? So if you were a Norwegian citizen, you definitely had better facilities for care than if you weren't. And with, you know, all the ways to look after yourself in terms of like no tourism, no work, no boats coming, etc. in Svalbard, how are people going to look after themselves? So you found there was a lot of people left actually during COVID to go back to where they originally came from, because they just couldn't live in this kind of civic registration framework. But however, saying that, it's unlikely that the situation in Svalbard, which is under the Svalbard Treaty, will stay the way it is, because there's already some issues, surprisingly enough, raised because of the soft shell crab, which is considered a mineral, actually. And so given the treaty says that everybody who signed the treaty has the rights to access the island and the waters around it. However, when the EU were fishing for the soft shell crab, Norway was like, no, you can't do that. And they banned it. And so there's now some issues around with Norway and the EU over the rights to, you know, to the seabed there. I went off on a digression there. I'm sorry. I got into the soft shell crab.
That's very good. I remember Canada Tai sort of argues for that you should, you know, always remember the future. So he's looking at reappropriating the power of interpretation. And that's how I see to your work, your research. leads us into these areas, Elaine, in a very refined way, which is very good. Is there anything else? Could you show us more of the work that you did in Svalbard? Is there a video there?
Yeah. I'm going to try and, oh yeah, there is a video. I can play 10 minutes of the Cold Rush video, or 2 minutes of the Cold Rush video.
But just, oh, you're going to do the Cold Rush. Okay. So I was going to also talk about the film that you had in the Worlds Without End. I'm forgetting which exhibition we're in now. But yeah. It's a wonderful collage where you appropriated all of the hollow earth theory. So you have this wonderful sort of side by side what is fiction and what is non-fiction, which created this third dimension as a viewer in the art gallery. You were going to do, is this real, is this unreal? And in many ways it's to me gets across the whole idea of the, you know, of what is true, what is fake news, what are we getting, what information feeds are we getting that we can believe? We're so saturated now that the difference between fact and fiction, of course, are all in a muddle, and we can't know which sources to trust or which not. And that's I saw that work, you know, side by side, very elegantly you portrayed. If you have a clip of that after your show, you're called.
Sure. But funnily enough, Michael, some people actually do believe in the hollow earth. So it is real to some people. And in fact, the Hollow Earth Society is based in Canada, in case anybody is interested in joining them. Anyway, I'll play this 2 minute clip and then we can play a piece of.
Just before you do that, just talk through what maybe you can talk us through it. What are we looking at here with this robotic arm?
Sure. This is actually a clip of the flag, which we have a replica of this flag in the gallery in here in Philadelphia in the slot. And this is the planting of the flag that Russia did in 2007, but then, you know, Canada felt was an aggressive move, claiming the Lomonos Ridge, this particular part of the Lomonos Ridge. So this is this little clip of that footage. And, you know, you're right, this whole film is a mixture of, like the one you just spoke about, is a mixture of found footage, mostly from army databases, and also footage I took in the Arctic when I went to Greece Fjord, and I interviewed the Inuit leader, Larry Anluluk, where he spoke about his family having to move to this part of the world and, you know, what happened to them. So yeah, the clip doesn't go, it's only 2 minutes. So the whole video is 11 minutes in total. Okay, maybe I'll stop it there.
I think so. You must have, I always get a fright looking at that. You must have taken your life in your hand on that with a camera in lane.
Well, funny enough, just as...
that was you, wasn't it?
No, it's funny. As I was looking at it there again, I was like, oh, Jesus. What I most remember about that was like actually nearly killing myself. Because... You know, it was clearly very, very cold. My equipment was suffering massively, and I was wearing, you know, spikes on my boots. But you know, you just kept on falling, carrying the equipment, lights, camera, sound equipment, in a very narrow glacier cave was a bit of a challenge.
The sense of claustrophobia that's there that comes with, and also the unexpected, what's around the next corner bend, that comes across, you know, what's next, constantly of being on the edge, which is the great metaphor, I suppose, for following the links, the hyperlinks that we have online, which is another, leads me to another question, I suppose, of the space, the virtual spaces that we're now inhabiting. I mean, now you're. Where are you? Are you in Philadelphia at the moment?
I am. Yeah.
Dublin, and you know, so we've got people in New York all over the place. So, how how our space, you know, doesn't have our borders anymore, but because we're in the virtual space of that, how has that changed how you make art today? Mm. Is that something? Because it's something that you, for a long time, Elaine, if I'm correct, you were exploring the virtual world with those gaming years.
Yeah.
Is that right? So you have these alter personas going on. And has that changed, really, how you make art?
You know, I like to think of those some of those projects as like my side projects, you know, that don't necessarily fit tightly into my practice, but, you know, are just, you know, sometimes when you have this kind of fun idea that you like, you know, I'd like to try this out and see where it goes. Do I think my practice has changed much in COVID? I'm not necessarily sure it has. The only thing I would say is, you know, given that I tend to go on the road a lot and film in places and difficult places to get to, sometimes very dangerous places, that's definitely been a problem because I haven't been able to do any of that. So maybe you're right in saying that some of my maybe more mad cap projects like the NFT area, I wouldn't have been doing that during COVID if I was on, you know, able to travel and kind of keep up with my, you know, practice in this field that I'm currently working in. So, you know, the NFT is something slightly different, but interesting in its own way. It's exploring something that is kind of like a parallel to the art world, even though people say, you know, NFTs are art, but, you know, they're this parallel thing. So yeah, it's, you know, sometimes to really understand something is to really try to do it and get to grips with what it is and how it works and then get a better understanding of it. And I guess that's the similarity between everything I do, you know, going and looking and seeing, you get a better understanding. Sometimes you have this idea of places until you go there. And then it's something very different. Like when I first went to Svalbard, I was thinking, oh gosh, this could be a really interesting idea, you know, utopia idea, until you realize, well, it is the Arctic. Nothing grows there, you know, nothing. Yeah. There are no trees. It's dark 6 months of the year. You know, is that the only place that people can go and live without a visa? That's pretty bleak, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Can I just leave on last question? As it's an open question, it's a provocative question, and it's following on the virtual world that previous question I was talking about. Who are our neighbors now? Who would you consider your neighbor? So it's coming from the old traditional sovereignty, Westphalian idea of sovereignty to globalized world. And you are certainly a citizen of the globalized world. Do you identify with anything that has who are your neighbors?
That's a good question. I guess you could say they're always changing, you know, if you think of this kind of space of flows to kind of a space of places. There is this, you know, the idea of the neighbor is a changing thing. The neighbor's always been changing. You know, your neighbor one week and your enemy the next, or your enemy one week and your neighbor the next. So, you know, that'd be my, you know, academic answer. You know, in terms of who I consider my neighbor, you know.
Okay. It's an unfair question, which is fine. Will we open it up to anybody else who would like to ask us some questions?
Feel free to unmute yourself and jump in.
I have a question. First of all, thank you both so much. It's Elaine, always excellent to learn more about your work. I'm always learning more. One thing I just want to comment on is very early in the conversation, you mentioned actually like the physical limitations of traveling your artwork, right? And the, you know, using materials like glass and coal and the kind of problems that that produces because of these very borders in which you're talking about. So one thing I was, you know, wondering is if you could say something about, I guess, like the accessibility of the artwork that you actually make, and if maybe media and video is something you're turning towards more, thinking about as a way to kind of circumvent the borders that are also critically part of your work. And then I guess I wanted to also ask you about the images of the fence prototype and just a kind of the relationship between your aesthetic choices there, right? Because it's this cube and it's their kind of serial photographs of the same image from the same point of view with the same distance. So I was thinking a lot about, the kind of seriality and like rigid gridness of the wall prototype and how that might relate to modernism, but also as, a comment on like this possibility of deterritorialization that your work seems to think through. So two questions. That was a lot. I'm sorry.
No, that's great. So I reached behind me and I pulled out for you the lovely panel of glass that we had in The Ocean After Nature, Elena. So yes, transporting things is really painful. And when this glass turned up in Philadelphia, smattered, it was a very sad day for me. So, you know, I have to say, I for sure, like I've moved very big sculptures from America to Ireland, and it's been, you know, they've got there. There's one time a truck arrived in Ireland and they said, you better come here, everything is broken. And I opened up the truck and I was like, no, that's what it's supposed to look like. So they're like, really? I was like, yeah, that's it. But, you know, for sure, there are more constraints now. Absolutely. The prices have gone up. It's much more difficult to transport things. It takes longer. And then there's no guarantee, particularly something like glass or even coal. These are very fragile things. There are major constraints and costs associated with it. You know, when you're being told it's going to cost you, you know, $7,000 to ship the coal, when you know it costs, you know, less than $1,000 in 2019. You know, that's a big difference. So, for sure, video photography has some advantages there in terms of, you know, being able to produce things in situation. But, you know, I have to say, I really do like to work with this materiality of mixing, this multimodality of mixing video with sculptural elements and how those sculptural elements contribute to the film work. Not like an installation, but more like adding a dimension to the complexity of the story, you know, bringing the story to life a bit more that the work is trying to communicate. So, so I can't see myself not working with objects. They're important still to me. Maybe it's also a pleasure principle that I get with objects that sometimes, you know, are not fully, you know, satisfied with the flat screen and photography. So that was the first part of, I think, your question. And the second was about the photographs on the grid. You know, first of all, I took a lot of photographs of those walls. I took a lot of photographs of the spaces between the walls. And, you know, I was interested in, you know, this, you know, the space between them, because that's equally interesting, isn't it? What happens in the gaps. But, you know, given where I was photographing on this dirt track in front of the wall on a customized platform, I was a little bit limited to how I could photograph them. So I decided to do it in this kind of grid fashion, where I literally would photograph the, in a way, two grids, you know, the opposing views of each other, and have them in this kind of structure. So it was a practical decision combined with a little bit of aesthetics. But yeah, I mean, the grid is something, of course, that's you know, I think, you know, as artists, we all think about a lot. And also, you know, you can't get away from when you're thinking about borders and maps. The grid is so important, you know, for that.
Could I jump in there on that? Because during the lockdown, you know, exhibitions organizer hat on, there was a lot of discussions among institutions about the sort of the debt of the blockbuster exhibition because of the expense of transporting artworks around the world, how that was affecting the climate and whether institutions should be looking at climate change and seriously address it or rather than add to it, etc. So there was this kind of discussion about whether the day buster is over. Now, there were a number of exhibitions we've seen, the Guston and Warhol happen both in Europe and in America across the Atlantic. And so, but those exhibitions had already been planned, you know, well, 3 years in advance of that. Since then, I haven't seen too many of the blockbuster exhibitions going on that are traveling internationally. So that's kind of an interesting, you know, result, I think, of what has happened during the pandemic, because budgets have been cut, people were not so sure of the things. And then there was this trend at that time to go online. And also when I'm thinking of Liam Gillick and the sort of idea of where the production of the artwork is the exhibition. So, famously doesn't have a studio, he works on his laptop and the production becomes the exhibition. And maybe that's kind of with the rise of NFTs, that is possible. Where a lot of artists are investigating to try and circumnavigate these challenges that have come about. There's no doubt about it. With Brexit, new borders that have come up, the cost of producing exhibitions on a large scale has astronomically increased. Mm-hmm. That it's going to be hard to meet those challenges now.
But of course, Michael, there are one of the critics of you could say of NFTs is they're not sustainable either. They use a tremendous amount of energy, and seemingly one NFT is the cost of running one household for 24 years. So like that's so a lot of artists then try to offset some of that footprint, but I don't know. I mean, let's see.
It's not an area I know too much about either, but it's interesting that that's a discourse that's going around at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I'm particularly interested in that as well because of women in tech and women in NFTs. There's a parallel there to very little women in both.
Yeah.
Elaine?
Hi.
Hey, can you see me? Can you hear me?
Greg? I can hear you.
Okay.
I can see you now. Hi, Greg. Hey, nice to see you.
Good to see you. Aaron, good to see you. I'm just curious, maybe this is something you haven't really gotten to yet, but being in Philadelphia and myself having been born there and my Irish family coming from Philly, have you done anything local inside that strange city that might, or are you thinking about working in that specific area?
Yeah, I have started a few kind of projects that I haven't, I'm thinking about. One being around, I started photographing places that were in the Rocky One movie, Frank.
Okay. A great film.
Yeah, great film. And Tusculum Street around that area, which is, which was rough in the days that Rocky was filmed, but oh my God, it's a lot tougher now. So just comparing scenes of the imagery from the film with contemporary images of the same places. And so I've been looking at it in terms of place and you know, how place changes, etc. You know, so yeah.
You might also want to look into Mayor Frank Rizzo, whose statue was recently removed. And when I was growing up, by then in the suburbs of Philly, he was an incredibly racist son of a bitch who went from police commissioner to being mayor somehow later down the road. Nobody could believe it, but he rounded up the Black Panthers and humiliated them in public. And it's a really interesting, I think, subtext or maybe sort of contrast to good old Rocky Balboa, you know.
So. Yeah. No, I've also was looking at doing something with the coal miners here that are outside the city. And I went out, obviously, that's where I got the coal originally from. And I went out there. And that's extremely interesting as well. And that whole area of Pennsylvania and just the coal belt and, you know, what's still open, actually, and their attitudes to coal. So I found that really, really interesting. And I'd be interested to do something there.
Well, we'll talk more about it.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm looking forward to hopefully you getting down here, you know, maybe for the in-person
it's
event.
It's on my calendar. I'm going to try to come down for the 11th. When
fantastic.
So do you have any comments about, or have you done any work on the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland? And its changes over the last 50 years?
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, I started filming that the border this summer. I was particularly interested in this, you know, I don't know if you were following, but this issue of the border having to be placed in the sea. But of course, it's not really a border because it's this border that was a customs border that was going to have to somehow be located somewhere between Northern Ireland and England to allow for customs to be handled correctly coming into Ireland. So I was very interested in this notion of, you know, the borders in the ocean. So I went and filmed. I got some funding from the Irish Arts Council, which was fantastic because I was able to go with a drone operator. And we filmed basically going along the border. And it was, you know, it was interesting because, you know, asking a boat captain to take me out there, he's like, what do you want to go out there for? Like, you know, there's no flags out there. There's no like line. I think I know that. That's the point. The point is, you know, you go there, you crisscross it, and you know, nobody pays any attention to you. So it's this kind of fantasy notion of where the border is in the ocean. And you know, that the border actually isn't where you think it is, the border is somewhere else. And possibly it's sitting in London or sitting in Dublin, or it's sitting in your fingertips or your, you know, and your eyes. So really thinking about that notion of, you know, where the border actually is, and it's not necessarily located where you think it is. So I've been thinking about that in relation to Ireland, but I'm interested in borders in a very broad sense, where, you know, there are so many being built at the moment. And why is that happening now? Why now? What is it that they are doing that, you know, is somehow satisfying nations and satisfying people? So in a way, trying not to locate it too tightly to a US-Mexican border or to a, you know, a Berlin Wall or an Irish UK place, but just say, this is a global phenomenon. Why is this a global phenomenon? What are they doing? Or what are they purporting to do? What is it that they're giving us? So, yeah, that's kind of a roundabout answer, I think, Abe, to yes and no is the answer there.
Thank you.
I can answer that, Abe, in that we went in the Worlds Without End exhibition, which was we showcased there in 2020. There were two artists that we showed that represented work on the Irish border. One was Dermot Seymour, was originally from Belfast and did some early paintings in the 1980s of the Troubles and the madness and surreal style that he used was the sort of agricultural cows alongside the British paramilitary helicopters flying. And so it's this sort of surreal space that he has created in the 80s. Since then, he moved down south. But it was interesting as a sort of a time warp to sort of get an insight into that historical moment. And that's why I chose him and represented him in the exhibition. But the second artist then was an artist called John Byrne. And after the Good Friday Agreement, 2 years in 2000, he did a performance of a piece called The Border Interpretive Centre. So he found this sort of shop, and set it up as a sort of a mini souvenir museum on the border, and sort of in a sort of comic satirical way set up the, how we should celebrate the border, because it was basically now it was a thing of the past, and that we could after 30 years of we were able to laugh at it, which meant it was sort of something that was kind of being in the distance. And over the 20 years that since the Good Friday Agreement, there was sense of a new generation coming up and forgetting about the seriousness of the border. And the reason for revisiting this as a topic was interesting in that, Brexit was on the horizon and has proven to be very complex and difficult, causing a lot of problems. But it was on the horizon. And so it was just kind of as an exhibition space to raise that consciousness in the audience again. Of the importance of the border, the importance of what Brexit is doing, the insecurity of the British society to actually put up and suggest that there's a border again. All sorts of suggestions have been put in place at the moment in that it should be electronic border, but anything that becomes physical, the danger of it being a target for raising tensions and violence again on the island of Ireland are very real and very serious. These are the intersections then between art and society, I guess, that we deal with. So in relation to the Irish border, that's an ongoing project.